This is BookTV's Afterwards podcast. This week, Washington Post Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic Carlos Losada offers his thoughts on the volume of books written about Donald Trump and his presidency. He's interviewed by New York Times Book Review editor Pamela Paul.
Hi, Carlos. So good to talk to another book journalist or book critic. How do you primarily think of yourself these days?
I still think I very much see myself as a book critic. This book is just sort of an extension of that work. But these days, I feel like I'm a political journalist also in many ways, and just using books as a means to that kind of work.
And also an author, obviously. This is your first book. What was it? Did you know that you always wanted to write a book as a book critic, or is that something that you actually kind of steered clear of?
I did not have a sense that I wanted to necessarily be an author or write a book. Reading other people's books was plenty for me. And I worried a little bit that if I went through the process of writing a book, I would end up sort of far too sympathetic to authors and ruin me for my day job. But I think it's been really useful, actually, to see what that side of the process is like and all the work that goes into creating that finished product that I usually just get at the tail end.
Do you think it's going to change your approach at all as a book critic?
I think it almost has to. I don't know how it will, though. I want to see when I'm sort of back in the swing of just reviewing a lot of books. But I suspect that it has to in some ways, beyond just sympathy for authors. I hope that it'll give me a better sense of the decision making that goes into what a book covers, how many chapters, why do you devote attention to this or to that? So I hope it'll make me better at my main job, which is as a book critic.
Well, now you know all the answers. But this book, obviously, you didn't steer too far away from what it is that you do during the day, and that you read 150 books about the Trump era for this book. Do you think of this as a book about books, or is it something else?
At a basic level, I think it is a book about books. I think of it like Kramer's coffee table book about coffee tables from Seinfeld. But I hope that it simply uses books to try to understand a moment, to try to get a snapshot of a moment. And so I think in that sense, it could have been a lot of things. It could have been film, it could have been theater, it could have been fiction, right? Because I focus mainly on nonfiction. And so I think it is mainly a book about this moment in American civic life. And books just happen to be the prism through which I understand it.
You call this a book also about an intellectual history of the Trump era, a subtitle that some people might consider to be, sort of inherently oxymoronic. But what do you mean by an intellectual history?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of ways to imagine an intellectual history. There's been this common exercise during the Trump years of trying to find that one book from like 1973 that, anticipated everything, or this one essay that saw it coming. And I've done some of that myself, guilty. But that's not the kind of book I wanted to write. I wanted to grapple with how America's public intellectuals and writers and insiders and academics and journalists, how they were thinking about this moment in real time. So maybe a better way to explain it is to think of it as a snapshot of an intellectual moment that I hope perhaps future intellectual historians can look at to get a sense of how we thought about Trump in the moment.
It's interesting that you talk about books that oversimplified things into this is how we got here. This is how this happened. And it right after the 2016 election, there was this increased interest and sales of in particular novels that sort of presaged the current moment, 1984, of course, Brave New World, all these sort of post-apocalyptic novels suddenly became bestsellers again. And then you had the books that sort of said, well, this is what this means. This is what's happening in the current moment. Now, are we moving into this, a sort of third phase of this is what this is going to mean moving forward? This is what's going to happen next? These are the implications?
I hope so. I hope that we'll be getting that new wave of books. I think that there's been this, and the quantity of books that I read and reviewed and thought about is sort of testament to this. There's been this obsession with trying to understand how we got here, why Donald Trump was elected in 2016, and what the future can hold in American politics. I do hope that we might try to move beyond a sort of singular obsession with the occupant of the Oval Office and do a little better at grappling with the forces that brought Trumpism, into American life.
Thus the title, presumably, what were we thinking, not what were they thinking or what was he thinking?
Yes, I definitely, there's been enough psychoanalyzing of Donald Trump in book form. I did not want to do more of that. In fact, the original discussion of the title started with what were they thinking, but I wanted to be more all encompassing with that. I didn't want to absolve anyone of responsibility or of agency. And it's certainly not a book about what administration officials were thinking, though there is some of that in some of the insider memoirs. But I want it to be as broad as possible with this sort of sweep of thought and of writing.
What did you make of the fact that early interest, those early books that people started to turn to explain what was going on, were mostly fiction, novels, and memoirs?
Mm-hmm. I did some of that myself. I went back and read Sinclair Lewis, It Can't Happen Here, and The Plot Against America, Philip Roth, and wrote about those in the time. So I certainly engaged in that sort of soul searching through fiction. But I think it spoke to how so many people thought that this just seemed kind of impossible, right? No one, if it's about what were we thinking, we weren't thinking that hard, right? There was this sense in which Trump couldn't be elected. Right. Even Trump's own campaign didn't necessarily think it was going to happen. And so I think that we drew on fiction early on because it fit in with that sense of unreality, of kind of like this sense of there's been this sort of weird like time displacement vibe that the Trump years has given us, where people talk about how, the weeks feel like months and the months feel like years. And all that, I think, is part of that sense that this is not normal, that this is not something that really could be happening. And so I think fiction was the natural outlet for that, even though we sort of quickly moved beyond it.
Well, speaking of quickly and speaking of abnormal tempos, the usual pattern with books about a certain, a particular administration is that people leave office, their cabinets, disband, and maybe 5-10 years later, someone in retirement writes a memoir, Dean Acheson will write Present at the Creation. Now you have, in this administration, people writing memoirs, sort of 2 minutes and tell-alls out the door. What do you make of that? And to what extent did you devote yourself to reading those kind of quickie tell-all memoirs from people who were in the Trump circle and left?
Yeah, remember how insane it seemed when George Stephanopoulos wrote his memoir of the Clinton years while Clinton was still in office? I mean, it was this huge controversy, right? About how dare he do that? And he was sort of exiled from Clinton world for a long time. That is just now, you know, absolutely like, you know, you, the moment you're fired or you resign, you like go straight to the literary agency, you know? And so I did try to read a lot of those books. I didn't read all of them as soon as they were out. You know, I sort of, you know, came to others later on. And there's a certain urgency and immediacy with them that I think is great, is helpful. They sort of give you an instant sense of what it was like inside. But I think that also makes them a little, you know, what's the word? It makes them feel ephemeral, right? It makes them feel like they, you know, they aren't going to last very long, and they'll be superseded by just the next, you know, immediate insider tell-all memoir of the Trump administration. Also, with all these books, they just make you, you know, they obviously present themselves in the best possible light. Everyone is the hero of their own story, and of course, all those stories can't be consistent and can't be exactly true.
I was going to say, like, did you get this kind of Rashomon-like experience where you're like, okay, and now we are switching the angle and seeing this particular meeting from this person's point of view?
There was a lot of that. In fact, there was even one particular meeting of Trump early on in the presidency, meeting at the Pentagon with a bunch of senior officials who are basically staging an intervention, trying to get him to kind of see the world their way. And multiple books, including insider memoirs, but also journalistic accounts of the early Trump period, did the same thing. You know, they just all obsess with, you know, one meeting or one moment or one conversation. And you put them all together and you basically get like a running transcript of the meeting. It sort of feels almost cinematic.
Yeah, there's a line in your introduction where you say, individually, these books try to show us a way forward. Collectively, they show how we're stuck. What did you mean by that?
What I meant with that is that I think a lot of the books of the Trump era reflect the very same blind spots and sort of failures of imagination that gave us Trump and Trumpism in the first place. So people bring to all these stories and all these accounts their own blinders, you know. So all the political scientists, you know, say this is the death of democracy. The philosophers say it's death of truth. The internationalists say it's, you know, it's death of alliances. And the historians, of course, just say, you know, we've been here before. We've always seen this. And so you also see people finding validation for their long-held beliefs and theories about the world in Trump. And that's everyone from Naomi Klein, whose book, No Is Not Enough, you know, says, look, Trump is just proof of everything I've been saying all along, to your colleague at the Times, James Poniewozik, who wrote a really entertaining book called Audience of One, where he says, you know, Trump is the ultimate television character and is proof of all the things I've been writing about TV culture for decades. And so it doesn't mean they're all wrong. It just means that, you know, there's an easy tendency to retreat into familiar arguments when it comes to evaluating this period. And also, frankly, to just speak to the converted, to speak to whatever silo you're in. A lot of the books that came out of what I call sort of generally resistance writing fall into that category. You know, they're entirely inward looking. They look at Trump and see a broken moral compass and therefore assume that, you know, theirs always points north. And so I found that a little worrisome.
You're coming to this book probably with your own lens. You're a recent immigrant and a new citizen, rather, not a recent immigrant, right. But newly
a citizen. Yes. Citizen.
And your background is largely in foreign policy. Did you find yourself kind of looking at things through your own lens, and did you try to resist that in your assessment?
I'm sure that I did. I'll leave it to to, you know, critics and reviewers who are having at the book to identify my lenses. I think that certainly I came to the United States as a child, but I only recently became an American citizen. 2016 was the first election that I was able to vote in. And so I think that certainly has to have an impact on how I see this period, how I read books about the immigration debates of this time. But I also think that becoming a citizen, I mean, you know, immigrating to a new country, becoming a citizen is sort of an act of faith, I think, in whatever is the place that you're going to, right? Is this notion that you have confidence in the experiment that suddenly you're part of. And so I think underlying maybe my writing of this book is a sense of faith in the American experiment, faith that, you know, despite all the mayhem and all the fighting and all the controversy, that takes you someplace. But I also think that's just one identity, right? I think we all carry multiple identities that come to the fore in different moments. My faith, not just in America, but in reading, I think was significant in my writing this book. And they come together when you think about how, you know, this is a country that has always defined itself in writing, right? From common sense on, you know, all the big battles are litigated on paper, not only on paper, but on paper.
What can books do in trying to give a sense of this current moment that, say, journalism or the internet can't do? What does it do better?
I think, you know, and this is going to be unfair to journalism and to the internet, but I think that there's possibly a little bit of greater staying power in the act of committing words to book form. I think even our colleagues at the Washington Post and the New York Times, for example, who you know are very talented journalists who have covered this presidency in great detail, you know, through the just daily ongoing journalism, many of them have felt the need to try to take a step back and go deeper in book form. And I'm glad that they're doing that. I've read a lot of those books. And so I feel that if journalism is supposed to be the first draft of history, as Phil Graham said, the books are a first draft of how we think more deeply about that history, how we see ourselves in that history, how we decide what that history means. Now, we're going to be rewriting those forever. I think that I can only imagine that the best books on the Trump era have yet to be written. And
that's a commentary on the quality of the books you had to read for this book.
No, there were terrific books, but there's just going to be a lot more to think through and a lot more to understand. And even just new information to obtain as documents are declassified, as new investigations come forward. I think we're going to keep learning a lot more. I mean, there's a ton of memoirs. I mean, we talked about how many memoirs have been coming out from Trump officials. There's going to be a lot more. And on some of the key debates. I mean, I want to read Anthony Fauci's memoir if he writes one. You know, mm-hmm. I want to read Kirstjen Nielsen's memoir of her time at Homeland Security. You know, those are essential narratives that have yet to be fully told. And so, no, there've been wonderful books about the Trump era so far. I think that we're going to be with them for a long time to come.
I know that you are not writing about the man Donald Trump himself. Nonetheless, he is an unavoidable figure in all of this. And one of the things that I think it seems at least writers have been sort of saying in one way or another is that he's a very difficult figure to kind of pin down, to get an understanding of like what's going on inside of him. In the same way that I think biographers and famously Edmund Morris had trouble writing about Ronald Reagan. They just couldn't get a sense. Did you have that trouble?
You know, I had a slightly different perspective on that. This whole project for me began even before the book, just, you know, deciding that this was my beat, that I was going to be reading all these books, started in the summer of 2015 when Trump was first a candidate for the Republican nomination and was suddenly doing really well. So I went back and just read a bunch of his books. Even ghostwritten books reveal a lot about how someone wishes to be perceived. And so I read 8 Trump books, including, you know, the foundational document, The Art of the Deal, and several others. And it's all there. Like everything we've seen about Donald Trump is there. His kind of petty grievances and his obsession with kind of wealth and sex and his insecurities and his, mistrust of the press, yet, you know, constant quest for its approval, his willingness to lie and deceive. It was all in his own books. And so, you know, Trump can be shocking, but if you just spent time with his own words, it could not have been all that surprising. And
anything surprising though in there? Anything that you thought, oh, you know, people don't realize this about him?
One thing that I caught on to early on, and then you start seeing it through a lot of his books, is that, and maybe this has ceased to be surprising now, you know, 4 years or, you know, nearly 4 years in, but he did not, he liked acquiring things. He liked winning. He liked, getting the notoriety and attention that came with some big deal. Then to managing that thing, to running it, he got bored really quickly. And so I remember early on, I just thought, like, I can imagine him wanting to win the presidency. I can't imagine him really enjoying being president. Because that's a lot of work. And that didn't seem to be his MO in the books. He just kind of liked to go to the next thing, you know, and you see that in his personal life, you see it in all sorts of ways. And so I remember thinking, this is a guy who really wants to win the presidency. Winning is everything, right? His world is, you know, you're a killer or you're a loser. And but I couldn't imagine him really enjoying the presidency. And which is why we've seen that the parts that he has been drawn to the most have been the sort of theatrics and atmospherics of the presidency. You know, he loves signing stuff because that's what presidents do, right? He likes, you know, rallies because, you know, he feeds off that adulation. But he hasn't been a deal maker in office. He hasn't been able to do all those things that the day-to-day, you know, grubby job of presidenting, such as even, you know, getting the intelligence briefings and digesting them. So that was something that struck me when I wrote about him first back in the summer 2015, and but that I've seen sort of validated throughout the past 4 years.
I have another question about your subtitle, because what you're talking about, it's easy to think of historical precedents to the Trump era, and sort of the precedents that you would go to would depend obviously on your political leanings. But how did you define the era? Because a lot of people, when Donald Trump took office, sort of went back and they read Hannah Arendt and they read earlier biographies of what they would be considered authoritarian regimes. People went back, they looked at World War II figures. How did you define the sort of when these books start in terms of looking at the Trump era?
Right. That was a big challenge for me early on, because I felt that there was the risk of being too narrow in how I defined the period. But then I felt that opening it up too much, or it would sort of, there was always going to be something else that I would have to read and to incorporate. And so I decided to just be kind of ruthless and cast my own focus sort of narrowly, like, okay, I'm going to look at books that came out between 2016 and 2020. And even that is unfair, because the books that came out in 2016 were not written in any way to make sense of Donald Trump. I mean, a book like Hillbilly Elegy became a Trump book. It was not a Trump book to begin with. And so I decided, you know, and that'll be for you and critics to determine if it was wise or not, to just be very focused on this particular period, because I knew that opening the door would just you know, bring the deluge of different works that I would want to explore. I did that sometimes just for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, as I was reading and writing, I would read other books on periods that I, or experiences that I thought were relevant. But I decided to keep the focus of the books in my book on largely books that people were writing to grapple with this thing that was in front of us.
Let's talk about Hillbilly Elegy for a moment, because that was the first of what has, I think, become a kind of subgenre of books mm-hmm. that reflected something that happened in journalism after the election, which was everybody sort of said, let's send our reporters out to the heartland. Let's send our reporters to these, you know, industrial cities and rural areas and figure out who are the Trump voters. And that was kind of the one book or the first book that people latched onto. How well do you think that book kind of told that story? And are there others that did it equally or even better?
Yeah, I think Hillbilly Elegy told J.D. Vance's story very well, right? I think it was a very well-written book. It was a very affecting book to read. But I think a lot of it was timing that made people seize on it as, well, this is the Trump explainer book, right? And I think that was probably unfair to the book itself and to the Trump voter, right? In the sense that, you know, Vance tells a very personal story of growing up between Kentucky and then mainly in Ohio, and his own rather conservative politics, you know, color the way he sees that experience. But it had such broad appeal as the sort of, you know, quintessential Trump voter book, because I think it had, you know, it had a very kind of, you know, bootstraps thing, like, don't blame anyone else for your troubles. You know, that's a very loser thing to do. You know, his grandmother tells him that. And so, you know, he goes to the Marines and that shapes him up, you know. But it also had a very, so that's more of like maybe in a rough sense, the kind of conservative appeal, but it had the sort of appeal to the left as well, because you know, he works his way up to the meritocracy, ends up at Yale Law School, and you know, it also kind of affirms some kind of liberal suspicions of the white working class and the kind of like the social pathologies of this community. And so it had something for everyone. It sort of, you know, and that's why I think it became kind of across the spectrum, this book that people relied on. A book like Heartland by Sarah Smarsh, you know, is it's about her experience growing up in Kansas, farm country, but very much from the left, you know, very much from a totally different political perspective.
What was interesting is that the publishers really pitched it as, and this is the liberal Hillbilly Elegy when it was coming out.
And you know, that's unfair to, you know, to Smarsh, and you know, it was his own book, you know. In fact, it was in the works for, my understanding is, for a long time before that. It wasn't in any way a response to J.D. Vance, not in a temporal sense anyway. And you know, these are, it's not just like the difference between, you know, the mountains and the plains, right? These were just different ideologies that came to bear on this one political reality that is the struggles of the white working class. So I think that we put these books in conversation with each other. I certainly did that in my book. I start, you know, the opening chapter of the book is about all these books that I call the Heartlandia genre. And I spend a lot of time contrasting J.D. Vance and Sarah Smarsh. I also think a lot of the authors who aren't memoirists, who are like more these journalists that you talk about, who you know, dove into, you know, every Rust Belt town and chrome counter diner they could find, often kind of brought their own preconceptions to what they were covering, which is sometimes inevitable.
Well, here's another gross oversimplification, but it strikes me that you know, a good portion of the books that you describe in your book are books that explicitly set out to say, okay, here, I'm going to explain to you what's happening here. And then there are books like Hillbilly Elegy, like Sarah Smarsh's Heartland, that don't set out to do that, but which you found to be perhaps in many ways better ways to sort of vehicles to explain this period than the books that were sort of going at it directly.
I think that's right. I think that I felt, you know, good books have to accept kind of messiness, right? And when everything is too perfectly tied up in a bow, I always worry, like, what's been left out of this? You know, what am I not getting? And, you know, I found this pair of books that actually about, you know, that did that, that went out to look at, you know, the Trump voter, quote unquote. And in some cases, they even profiled the same people, which was bizarre. Like, there's this one voter in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, right, who was a longtime Democrat, labor organizer, who switched to Trump in 2016. And he's prominently featured, Ed Harry, he's prominently featured in two different books. And the crazy thing is these books give him significantly different motivations for supporting Donald Trump. In one book, he's this economic populist, you know, he worries the Democrats have forgotten, you know, the working class. In another book, he's a 9/11 truther, culture warrior. And really, he's the same guy, I suspect. But often he's interpreted through the prisms that journalists and writers bring to the story. And I don't want to sit in judgment of that. I just wanted to point it out and show how hard it is sometimes to avoid that.
So you've mentioned these prisms and these sort of areas of expertise that people kind of look through the particular lenses. We haven't talked explicitly about the most obvious one, which is ideological, that we live in such an incredibly polarized, you know, period right now in America. And I'm wondering, you know, did you sort of have to try really hard to find books that, you know, were not sort of ideologically 100% in the tank for Trump or in the resistance? Like, I guess they're the Never Trumpers, which are sort of over here. How hard was it to find books in the middle?
I don't know if it's the middle that we're looking for, right? Because you may end up, it's not like you have to be in the middle between resistance and base to get a clear perspective. You just have to not be sort of in the tank one way or the other. You may end up in a different place. So what I often did is I read a bunch of books just over the course of the 4 years, books that I was reviewing often for the Washington Post. But then when I realized I was going to try to take a bigger, more sweeping look at these books, I went back and sort of backfilled, you know, different areas that maybe I'd read, you know, five books on this, but I want to read five more. And there I could really kind of pick and choose, you know, different perspectives. And that was such a luxury for me to have the time to do that. I can only, you know, I could never do that like as an ongoing book critic. And I can only do it as an author in this case, where I had a little bit of time. And so, for instance, on these books about the white working class, I found this book that I had completely missed the first time. It's called We're Still Here by Jennifer Silva, a sociologist. And she, at first I thought it was going to be very similar to the others. You know, she spent time in Pennsylvania coal country talking to people. And I found though that she was able to, first she pointed out that, you know, the heartland is not entirely white. The working class is not just the white working class, it is as it has been sort of branded. And that this debate that we've had about the motivations of the heartland Trump voter, which has always been narrowed down to, you know, are they motivated by their cultural prejudices or their economic struggles, right? You know, her book helped me see how these are really intertwined, how it's difficult to sort of disaggregate and call person, you know, person A motivated by this, person B motivated just by that. And to show that more than seeing how these struggles push them to vote for Trump or push them to vote for somebody else, that they showed how they often leave them believing that there's no place in the political system for them at all. One of the most striking moments in that book for me, for instance, was Election Day 2016, because it was written during the 2016 campaign and then through Election Day. And the author, she went to vote. And she, you know, she comes back with her "I voted" sticker and she's all proud of herself. And she's then interviewing the people she's discussing in the book, and they laughed at her. They mocked her for thinking that, for daring to believe that the political system would be responsive to her preferences and to her voice, because that's how they felt about it. And so that to me isn't necessarily a midpoint between resistance and base, but it is an entirely different insight that really stayed with me as I read it.
Another version of the people who feel like there is no place for me here in this particular political landscape are the never Trumpers, the disillusioned conservatives, the people who sort of are questioning what happened to my Republican Party. I'm assuming that that was a whole kind of subgroup of books too. What were those like?
Yes, I read maybe four or five of the books by the more prominent Never Trump conservatives, and then in my book I put those, you know, in a broader chapter about the sort of divides among the right. And those were books that I felt you know, we're very focused on like what happened to my party, what happened to this movement that I've been a part of for so long. And I thought did a real sort of grappling and kind of lament about the conservative movement. I write in the book that they're sort of like book length breakup letters to their party and their movement. One thing that struck me about them though is that I didn't feel that they fully wrestled with sometimes their own role in what had come to pass. A lot of these had been sort of longtime conservative commentators or Republican campaign strategists. And, you know, they had been fine kind of, you know, feeding this base, or at least ignoring the kind of like, you know, really intense, you know, base of support that the party increasingly was embodied by, until they couldn't really control it anymore, until it didn't produce one of their more conventional Jeb Bush type nominees. And suddenly it's like, oh my God, what have we done? What have we created? And that, you know, that to me felt a little insufficient as a reckoning. That said, I think that, you know, they do a really good job at dissecting the problems and the evolution of the conservative movement, and kind of show the inability now to do what past generations of conservatives had done, which is kind of like, you know, purge the most extremist voices from the ranks. Those voices have kind of taken over and have left these kind of writers, you know, outside looking in.
One of the ways in which to view the kind of Trump line of the timeline of the Trump era, from my perspective as a book person, as a journalist, and I expect from your perspective as well, have been this series of, you know, huge embargoed books that, you know, you hear about the book, it's going to come out and the embargo breaks and everyone writes about it and everyone jumps on it, becomes a huge bestseller. And it's gone from, you know, Comey to the first Bob Woodward book, Fear, to Bolton, to the Melania Trump book, to the next Bob Woodward. But the one that I think has started it all was probably Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury. And you write about, you start a chapter about that book. The first line is, I blame Michael Wolff. What has he done and why does it matter?
First of all, I hate reviewing those books where I have like no time. I have to stay up all night reading them and then like just crash something together. And I always try to tell publicists and publishers, like saying, you're hurting yourself because you're not letting people, you know, really wrestle with a book. You know, just give me a few days, just slip it to me early. Give me just a few days to read it. But I never get anywhere. I think Michael Wolff's book is sort of perfect for like a time capsule of this period.
Because, bring people back to that moment, because it now feels like 20 years ago.
Yeah. So this was January 2018, right? He had spent a lot of, he had gotten, you know, amazing access hanging out in the White House. And clearly Steve Bannon seemed to be a significant sort of source and entry point for him. But it suddenly popped. Like, you know, we heard just a little bit, you know, just that it was about to show up. And suddenly it's in the world and it's the only thing anyone can talk about. It was, these books, as you mentioned, have become almost commonplace, right? You know, there's so many of them now, and they, you know, every few months there's like some huge bestseller. But this was the first, and it was mind-blowing. Everyone was talking about it. And I literally stayed up. I got the book on a Thursday afternoon, and I stayed up most of the night reading it. And I started writing the next morning, and I filed my review by 3 o'clock that afternoon on Friday. And Michael Wolff has, I think that book created almost a race for the most, you know, oh my God, can you believe that anecdote? A kind of arms race among these books that, like, all the Trump books to follow have been competing for, have been trying to get that story. And to my mind, it's done so. It's maybe a disservice to those subsequent books themselves, because sometimes the best stuff, you know, and the most deeply reported interesting revelations are not just the, you know, oh my God, you know, Trump in this meeting said this, or, you know, Trump stumbled while he was reading the words of the Constitution because he didn't know what they meant, or, you know, people steal documents off his desk. You know, those are memorable. But for instance, in a book like A Very Stable Genius by my colleagues, Phil Rucker and Carol Lenig, which was a huge bestseller, it was stuff like that that ended up kind of overpowering the conversation surrounding the book. And to me, that was far from the most interesting stuff in the book. Like, that was the first book where I learned, for instance, that Robert Mueller's team had passed up the opportunity to take a look at the letter that Attorney General William Barr was going to put out characterizing the Mueller report. Like, in hindsight, that seems like a big mistake. You know, in hindsight, I really wish they had looked at that letter first and maybe weighed in. And so, you know, I learned that in that book, right? But it was not in any way what dominated the discourse around it. It's the same with a book like Rage by Bob Woodward, where the 17 or 18 conversations between Woodward and Trump were the dominant part of the coverage surrounding the book. But in fact, the first half of the book is about, you know, major national security challenges, largely through the eyes of Jim Mattis, who was Defense Secretary, and Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence, and how worried they were about, you know, an actual nuclear conflict with North Korea. You know, like, that to me seemed like a really big deal. And those parts of these books often get overshadowed because of the Michael Wolff phenomenon, that we're just looking for the mayhem, for the for the insanity, but they became a little commonplace. I mean, Michael Wolff's second book on the Trump White House siege just kind of came and went. It did not receive anywhere the same kind of attention. I think because, you know, after a while, this was the presidency that shocked without surprising us really anymore. We were kind of used to that chaos.
It feels like, you know, we're constantly saying about the internet and the news cycle that it is so fast. We hardly have time to catch our breath, to understand what something means, to digest it. It sounds like the book cycle is sort of starting to mimic that in certain ways, that we, because there is this rush for these tell-all books with salacious, you know, anecdotes and juicy bits to dissect immediately, that we're losing some of what books generally do best, which is to offer a kind of perspective and deeper and broader thinking than you can generally get in the kind of rush of the 24/7 news cycle.
I think there is a risk of that. I think that if you go back and even just look at political campaigns, right? The book that is largely widely considered to be one of the greatest campaign books in American history is What It Takes. And that book came out, 4 or 5 years after the 1988 campaign, Richard Ben Kramer's book. That's unthinkable now, right? Like the books come out almost before the campaign is over, right? Even Game Change came out a year and a half after the race, after the 2008 race. You know, now they, you know, if they're more than a few months out, they feel incredibly dated. And I think that has to have an impact on the depth of the reporting, or even when they are very deeply reported, on just how much time the writers have to really think through and digest what they've uncovered. And so I do think that, you know, books are coming close to mimicking the speed of kind of long magazine pieces, right? And long magazine pieces are mimicking the speed of, you know, op-eds and blog posts. And that's probably less than ideal for readers, for writers who have to crash through material a lot more quickly, but also just for lack of a better term, for history, because, you know, people look back on these initial accounts to start crafting, you know, larger histories of a period. And we lose something probably in this kind of quest for speed. I don't see it going away though.
Well, you mentioned earlier, it obviously affects the way that you approach a review as a book critic. What gets lost? Well, let's start with, what do you try to do if you had, let's say, the luxury of 2 or 3 weeks to review something, to read and review something like Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury? Like, what would you have done with that extra time that you can't really accomplish when you're writing against, you know, a 24-hour deadline?
You know, with Michael Wolff's book, I'm not sure. I probably would have tried to contrast, for instance, some of his revelations or reporting with reporting at the time to see where things lined up, or where was he really delivering something totally new, or was it, or was he covering material that we've already, you know, been overwhelmed by. I think where it becomes more useful is in, so say, you know, soon we're going to get Barack Obama's memoir, right? Volume one of his presidential memoir, which is coming out on the 17th of November. And with a book like that, which I expect I won't get until very shortly before it's out, with a book like that, I'd want to do so much. I'd want to compare it to, you know, Dreams from My Father and Audacity of Hope. I'd want to look at other, you know, David Marinus's biography of Obama and David Garrow's and David Remnick. They're all Davids, I guess. And you know, see what I can find, see what stands out, see where maybe Obama himself has reconsidered things he had written before. You know, you want to put that sort of book in conversation with past works and with history in a way. You know, that book is going to both be a furthering of the Obama story, but it'd also be in conversation and in competition with other presidential memoirs. You know, like, how does it stack up against Clinton's book, or against George H.W. Bush's writings, or, you know, the gold standard, Grant's memoir, right? You know, there's so much you can do with a book like that, rather than just plow through it in a couple of days and then, you know, dash off 1,200 words telling people, you know, some of the highlights.
Do you spend those weeks ahead of time sort of doing that background reading?
I'm sorry?
Do you spend those weeks ahead of time, ahead of getting the book and sort of having to rush the writing of that review? Do you spend it doing that background reading, you know, reading the David's memoirs?
Sometimes I do. I did that when David Garrow's Obama biography came out a few years ago. I did read two other Obama biographies before that, because I wanted to see what was novel here. And when I can, I try to sort of fill in my the gaps in my own knowledge, which are considerable. You know, especially, you know, I moved back and forth a lot between the United States and Peru growing up, and I did most of my junior high and high school in Peru. And so I often feel like there's all these like huge chunks of Americana that I missed out on and that I never read. And so it's this constant insecurity. So yes, I am often, you know, reading prior works that I hope can give me some insight into whatever I'm going to be reading next.
Carlos, if it's any consolation, I've been here my whole life, basically, and I don't understand why every Obama memoir is written by someone named David either. So it's one aspect of Americana that's probably inexplicable. When you're writing a book like this, obviously, some of it, I imagine, is to answer questions that you have about, you know, what does this era mean? But obviously, you're writing for an audience, you're writing for readers to sort of translate all of these books and condense them and give them some kind of meaning or answer to readers. But I'm curious which questions motivated you personally. Like, what was it that you were trying to figure out for yourself in writing this book?
So I think it has to flow from the kind of writing that I do as a book critic. And when I'm you know, reading any single book, I'm trying to figure out you know, what is the underlying argument here? You know, what is left out? What is this writer bringing to the table that just, you know, didn't exist before? And I often get, you know, disgruntled writers telling me that I missed the point of their books. But my favorite response is when someone says, you know, like, you pointed out something in my book that I hadn't even realized was there. And so I think for me, that's like, you know, bingo, that's the great moment. And so I think I've tried to do that in my book. I've tried to do that with this whole universe of Trump books. I've been trying to see, you know, is there something that I can get at that is beyond the sort of very stark but simple divides of this period. And so, for instance, you know, when I encountered Jennifer Silva's book that I mentioned earlier, you know, it was that kind of moment for me. It's like, oh, this is a chance to look beyond, you know, is it economic struggles or cultural prejudice? This is a different idea. And that moment of insight, you know, which shouldn't be so rare, but, you know, these years has felt a little rare, is just like this warm bath that comes over me as a reader. And so I wanted to read these books in a sense to try to get past whatever my own kind of easy preconceptions and blind spots have been about different parts of the Trump era thus far. And what it's allowed me, I think the one thing I've walked away with is that all the fights that we're having, whether over immigration or over democracy or presidential norms or, you know, all the over identity and race, they are just a constant, ever-present part of the American story. They,
No, go ahead.
No. And those have been the best books for me, you know, the ones, and maybe this is obvious to everyone, but it wasn't necessarily so to me, that this is just, this is not an anomaly. It's maybe anomalous that they're happening all at once, but it's not an anomaly in the American story. And books that have helped me see that, that have shown how this period fits into the long arc of American history, have been the ones that have been both most helpful, sometimes most discouraging, but also the ones that just help you think like, okay, let's, you know, this is our turn.
One thing that struck me is that you mentioned in your book that you, certain books you'd actually reviewed and then reread for writing this book, that your own opinion of them changed over time. And I'm curious if there were other ways in which writing this book, your first book, changed the way you approach your work as a book critic.
There were certainly books that did that. Books where I felt, or it's not that sort of as a book that I loved and then I read 3 years later and suddenly I hated, or the other way around, but it was more that I saw different things in them, that what had struck me most the first time was not at all what I found most important the second time around. Timothy Snyder's book on tyranny did that for me, for instance. At the beginning, I was struck by its very prophetic, you know, post-truth is pre-fascism, these very dramatic moments in the book. And when I was rereading it in 2019, 2020, what strikes me most about that book is his refrain of just being mindful of protecting key institutions, right? Just, you know, pick institutions you care about and stick by them. And so I felt that with some books, I just encountered things that I may have just like passed over quickly the first time around. And I do imagine that it'll maybe give me some more humility when I'm reviewing, knowing that, you know, all I can do is grapple with a book in the moment. And whatever strikes me. But to sort of have enough self-awareness to realize that, you know, this may not be the most important thing about this argument or this book, and that there's a certain ephemeral nature to my own deep probing insights about each of these works. These are people who spend years, you know, lifetimes sometimes, you know, on this work, and I show up and I spend a couple of days reading them and then trying to pass, you know, some kind of judgment on them. It seems grossly unfair. And I think having to reread and reconsider these books is useful for me, because I realize that there's often more there than I anticipated.
Well, Carlos, you've already won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism for your book of criticism for The Washington Post. You've read more than 150 books on the Trump era for your first book, and now you'll be a kinder critic to boot. So congratulations on all of that.
Thank you so much, Pamela.
Thanks for listening to this week's Afterwards podcast. Subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Send us an email at podcasts@c-span.org.